Hi, my name's Bob, and I'm an alcoholic. It gives me great honor to introduce this gentleman. He's a true testament on what it is to live one day at a time. He's been uplifting to me and our home group at the Depot Group in Kennesaw, and I've only known him for a year or two, a short time, but it's just been unbelievable, the knowledge and all the background that he's had. With no further ado, I'd like to introduce Jim, our friend and my sponsor. Thank you.
Excuse me for the delay. I mean, we're taping, so I had to do a little technical thing there. Good morning. My name is Jim, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey,
I'm a happy alcoholic. I'm a sober alcoholic. I'm a grateful alcoholic, but I'm an alcoholic. And thanks for the nice introduction, Bob. I listen to introductions carefully. Years ago, I was on a lecture circuit. I had nothing to do with AA. It was knife and fork clubs. And for some reason, I was introduction prone. Some people are accident prone. It happened to me during introductions. I remember speaking one night at a group where the guy said, before our speaker of the evening, I have an announcement to make. He said, next month our meeting will be held in the high school auditorium rather than this little church chapel because we have a really good speaker and we're expecting a much larger crowd. Another night they had a bingo game planned for later in the evening, and the chairman that night said, don't forget it's bingo night, and as soon as our speaker's through talking, we're all going to have a good time. So that may give you some idea of what to expect this morning. Maybe they really meant it that way, I don't know. I want to give you a very brief biographical sketch of myself. I don't know about you, but when I hear a speaker, I sit there wondering for hints about how long this guy's been sober, where is he from, what's his background, what did he do for a living, that kind of stuff. So I'll give you a quick rundown, not because it's important, but because it had something to do with my drinking and with my sobriety over the years. I was born in Cleveland, Ohio, so I'm one of those Yankees. I lived there for 49 years, and I worked in the television business, radio and TV. I was a disc jockey. I was a news anchor for a while. I did a lot of things in TV. I moved to Hawaii in 1975, and I lived in Hawaii for 25 years. I moved to Georgia 4 years ago. After a serious illness, my family was here. My wife had passed away, and I was alone in Hawaii and felt I wanted to be nearer my family. So I moved here and have been very happy here. I got sober in 1960, so I've had 44 years of sobriety in the AA program, which is a long time. I hasten to add that that does not make me an expert on alcohol or on sobriety. I don't know any more about it than you do. I do it the same way everybody else does in this program. I was told very early on in the program that getting chased around a tree by a bear does not make you an expert on either trees or bears. And that's true. So I'm not an expert on alcoholism, and I'm not an expert on sobriety. All I know is that if I do what they tell me to do and told me to do in AA in the first day I was in the program, I stay sober. So I try to do that. I don't know when I became an alcoholic. I used to worry about that. I started to drink when I was about 17 in high school. It was a little group of us that drank a little, not a lot, not in trouble, but some, and it was fun. I drank till I was 34 years old. The last 3 years of my drinking was not fun at all. And I often thought that's where I became an alcoholic, the 3 years before I got into AA. I, however, remembered that I had my first alcoholic blackout when I was 19. I had been drafted. It was right at the end of World War II. I was in the Army, and I went to a big party at an American Legion Hall in Vallejo, California, near where I was stationed. I had been in a fight. I don't know who I fought with or why. From my condition, I obviously was not the winner of the fight, although I don't remember it. If I was the winner, the loser was dead, I tell you that, because I was in pretty bad shape. But I remember absolutely nothing. I came to standing in the bus dispatcher's office in a Greyhound bus terminal, complaining that a bus driver had tried to run me over. And I have no idea what that was all about. But that was my first blackout, first of many. I went on with many more during the course of my drinking. I came to once sitting in my car, parked in the parking lot of Cleveland Hopkins Airport. And I didn't know whether I was coming home or going someplace. I had no idea why I was there. I never did figure it out. I came to once sitting at a bar in a strange place. I knew nobody. I didn't recognize the surroundings. I had to go outside and look at the street sign to tell where I was. And I recognized the names of the streets, and it was in Cleveland, but it was in a neighborhood that was nowhere near where I lived, nowhere near where I worked, no reason for me to be there. I had no idea why I was there. I didn't know where my car was. But that happened often. I almost never knew where my car was. I had to walk around the block until I found it parked on a side street. I walked around my car a lot, usually in the morning, to see if there were any new dents in it or if I'd hit anybody the night before. I had a lot of trouble with automobiles. My wife and I tried to figure it out once, and as close as we could come was that I smashed up 10 cars in 9 years or 9 cars in 10 years, but we're not sure which. Never were sure. But I know I had a lot of trouble with automobiles, with the blackouts, with a dangerous way of life, really. I came to once out of one of these blackouts, and I was roaming the halls of a tenement apartment house on the east side of Cleveland in the middle of the night, and I have no idea why I was there, roaming up and down the halls of a strange apartment house, and I could have been shot. Well, I didn't get killed. I didn't get killed in any of the automobile accidents. Fortunately, I didn't kill anybody else, but I could have. I never went to jail, but I could have, should have, probably on some occasions. My wife was, shall we say, distressed by my behavior at this time. That's a bit of an understatement. It was something more than distressed. I remember one night I sort of came to. I was home, and I'd been in bed for a while. I usually came home eventually and just sort of passed out. And I woke up and heard her crying. And I went in the bathroom, and she was running cold water on her hands. And I asked her what the problem was. And she said, "Don't you know what the problem is?" And I said, "No." And she couldn't believe that I was unaware of why her hands hurt. She had been beating me on the back of the head in bed with her fists. She was so angry at me. And I didn't even know it. I was so passed out, so blacked out, that I didn't even know I was being hit. And she bruised her hands, beating me in the back of the head. So I guess you would call that distressed. She was that. My daughter was 6 years old at the time I came in the program. She didn't trust me, couldn't trust me, never knew how I was going to act or what condition I'd be in. My parents were alive and disappointed, I'm sure. They knew what my problem was, and they were disappointed in their only child. I don't know whether I had any friends left or not. I didn't really care whether I had any friends left or not. There were certainly some people that I knew, people that I worked with, people that I saw every day, and they either had pity or contempt for me. If they knew what was wrong with me, they pitied me, and if they didn't understand that it was a disease, they had nothing but contempt for me. I remember one day one of the other announcers came through a big soundproof door onto a studio and hit me in the middle of the back with it. He was running into the studio. It was late for something. And I was standing inside this door, and he banged me in the middle of the back. And instead of saying, excuse me, or are you hurt, or, you know, whatever you would normally say to a person under those circumstances, he said, gee whiz, Jim, I hope I didn't break your flask. That was the kind of sarcasm that I lived with. I was known as the station lush. I had a boss, a station manager, who was a former newspaper man, who drank himself. He used to talk to me about my drinking, and I thought he was a big hypocrite because he drank. He actually was my best friend, and I didn't know it for many years. He tried to keep me on. He was the most forgiving man, as I think back on it, that I've ever known in my life. He'd find me drunk and asleep in the men's dressing room, and instead of firing me, he put me back to work. And he tried and tried and tried to do something with me about my drinking. And I wouldn't listen to him. I wouldn't listen to anybody. I was living my own life, going along saying I'm not hurting anybody but myself. And I didn't even really believe that I was hurting myself at that point. My life degenerated into one of humiliation, embarrassment, and degradation. I was humiliated constantly by cracks like the station lush and that sort of thing. I was embarrassed by my own behavior because I knew it was often wrong. And to be drunk in front of your parents, to be drunk every Christmas day, to be drunk constantly is embarrassing. And I found myself degrading into a lifestyle that I never set out to live. I didn't want to be that kind of a person. I remember one election day in Ohio. I don't know whether it's still true, but in those days the bars were closed on election days. You couldn't sell booze until the polls closed, the end of the day. So a guy like me had to prepare very carefully to go to work on election day because the bars were going to be closed. And I remember leaving the house that day with a big overcoat. And it was a warm day in Cleveland for November. And my wife asked me why the big coat when I went out the door. And I made some excuse about, well, you never know, the weather's changeable. It could get cold by the time I come home. The reason for the big coat, of course, was I had pint bottles of whiskey in each of the coat pockets in brown paper bags. I had to pack a lunch because the bars were not going to be open all day. And I went to work, and by that time I had been taken off all announcing assignments. They didn't trust me to announce anymore. And I was stuck away in the basement of the station as a writer. Didn't write anything anybody paid for. I wrote public service announcements and promotional announcements and cheap stuff, because that's all they could trust me with. So I went to work, and I went down to my little office, which was hidden away in the basement, and I wrote for a while, and about 10:30, I needed a drink. And I put on this big overcoat and went out for a coffee break. And no sooner got out of the front door of the station than the thought struck me, where am I going to go with this bottle of booze? I couldn't be seen drinking it. Where could I go to drink that whiskey? The station was in an area of downtown Cleveland called Playhouse Square, where there were a number of theaters. And at that hour of the morning, the lights were just beginning to twinkle on the marquees of the big theaters downtown. So I bought a ticket to the Palace Theater and went in, and went immediately to the men's room, locked myself in the pay toilet, and drank a pint of booze. Got myself feeling fairly normal and went back to work. I didn't go to lunch that day. No reason to go to lunch. The bars were closed. 2:30 in the afternoon, I needed a drink again. And this time I knew where to go. But I was afraid the girl at the box office would wonder why I was going to the same movie twice in the same day. So I walked down the street and bought a ticket to the Lowe's Ohio Theater. and went in and locked myself in the bay toilet and drank the other pint of whiskey. And then went back to work and made it through until the polls closed, the bars opened, and I could get down to my normal serious drinking. And I thought I was the man of distinction. Remember those ads for some whiskey company used to run full-page ads on the back of Esquire magazine? The man of distinction in the smoking jacket in front of an open fireplace with a Dalmatian on the bearskin rug and swirling the right booze in the right glass and talking about politics with a good friend. That was me, the man of distinction. My sponsor and I used to kid about that. We both thought we were pretty fancy drinkers, men of distinction. And if you had put us in that scene, one of us would have fallen in the fireplace, one of us would have thrown up on the dog, and we would have ended up in a fist fight, I'm sure, over politics. Because we weren't men of distinction. I never saw one of those ads that showed a guy sitting in a pay toilet drinking it out of a pint bottle in a brown paper bag. That just is not their idea of a man of distinction. But that was me. I used to pretend I had flat tires. I know, because I'd come home late. I'd stop and get out of the car and rub my hands on the tires to make them dirty so I could tell my wife that I had a flat tire on the way home and had to change it on the road. How many times do you think I tried to pull that on my wife? How many flat tires did I have per month? Lots. How many times did I fool her? Never. But I kept trying. I was a little worried about drinking in the morning because I had read, my wife used to leave articles alongside my chair, and it was always 10 reasons why you're an alcoholic or 10 checkpoints. It's always 10. I don't know why it's always 10, but in those articles. But you're supposed to read the article, and if you answer 5 of them yes, then you're an alcoholic. They were in Woman's Home Companion and Reader's Digest. Yeah, they come up all the time, and my wife would always leave them where I could find them. On the first day that I read one of those and answered all 10 questions yes, my reaction was, any damn fool can write an article, and I threw it away because I didn't believe it. But nevertheless, I didn't believe I was an alcoholic. I worried about that morning drink, so I saw an ad on TV for something called Emmetrol. Do any of you ladies know what Emmetrol is? I know the men don't know. Emmetrol is something that ladies take that's supposed to help them control morning sickness when they're pregnant. And I figured I was sick in the morning. I'd get up and stick that toothbrush in my mouth and immediately gag me, you know, and I'd be throwing up. So I bought Emmetrol. I thought it might help. It didn't help. It made me throw up green. That's all it did. So I later got, knew a guy in a drugstore, and I'd buy cherry syrup from him in a little bottle, little medicine bottle. He'd get it out of the soda fountain. And I would put vodka in a bigger medicine bottle and color it red with the cherry syrup. It was my special cough medicine, which I kept in the medicine cabinet at home. That was my morning cocktail, so I could get my teeth brushed. There was whiskey in the car. My wife started to find it under the front seat, so I'd leave a bottle with a little bit in it under the front seat for her to find and quit looking. The full one was in the trunk. We're pretty devious about that hiding, and I thought I was a champion at that. It turned out later that I wasn't at all. I never even thought of some places to store the booze or to hide it. I found more good places after I got sober in AA than I ever thought of myself. My own sponsor used to keep it in a garden hose, capped at both ends and rolled up in the garage. And he went out to do lawn work. He'd unreel about 2 feet of hose and drink booze. It tastes like rubber, but it did the job. You know? He also kept it in the furnace So it was on slow simmer all the time. That did the job too. All of this ended up in 1960, late August, with me getting laid off. The boss finally got fed up. And he told me to go home, had no job for a drunk anymore, no writing jobs, no announcing jobs, no jobs. He said, you can come back, if you can come back sober, and give me some indication that you can stay that way. So I went home, and I figured I could go right across the street to another TV station and get a job without any trouble at all with my experience. I barely got through the interview for the other job. I certainly didn't get the job. I was unemployable at that point. I went home and went to bed because I was sick. And I got a phone call from a man that I knew in the business. I didn't know him well. He was a very good broadcaster and a very famous guy in Cleveland. He was one of the guys that I looked up to a lot. And he told me he was an AA, which I did not know. And my opinion of him immediately dropped considerably. I thought, he's one of those, you know. I had no idea he was that kind of a bum. But he was trying to help me, and I hung up on him. I suddenly became aware that there was a strange guy sitting at my bedside who I had never seen before in my life. I figured my wife had called him. It turned out she hadn't. One of the engineers at the TV station knew that I was a drunk, knew I'd been laid off. He went to church with a guy that he knew was an AA, and he had talked to him, and he had come to my house and made a cold call. He was a lawyer. And he sat at my bed, and he talked about himself, mostly, and his own story. And somehow, that guy talked me into going to Rosary Hall, which was the ward at St. Vincent Charity Hospital. Sister Ignatia ran it. She was the one who founded the ward at Serenity Hall at St. Thomas Hospital in Akron. She was the one who put the Dr. Bob and Bill's first baby to bed in the closet at St. Thomas Hospital and said, I will keep him anonymous and take care of him until you visit. She was in on the start of this program from the very beginning, and she was running Rosary Hall at that time. The first few days in Rosary Hall, I thought I was on a boat. I thought I was on a cruise. I kept asking people how long they'd been aboard, you know. And where's the social director and stuff? I don't know why. I'd never been on a boat in my life. But I thought I was on a boat. Then for a few days, I thought I was undercover. I was a reporter, and I was going to write an expose of this crooked nun and this racket she had going up here, taking advantage of us poor, unfortunate alcoholics. They tapered me off. I had my last drink on September 4th, 1960. It was old Bardwell and Peraldehyde. The Peraldehyde was supposedly to ward off the DTs. It didn't work. But I remember the toast. It was in a paper cup, and the nurse handed it to me. And she said, that's all you get, buddy. That was my final toast. I hope she's right. So far, she's been right. I hope she's right for a long time to come. But I did get the DTs later that night. And it wasn't scary. My DTs were very entertaining, I have to admit. I looked out the window, and there was a rumble going on in the parking lot across the street. Teenage kids, mostly, armed with knives and chains, and they were fighting each other. Blood was running in the street, and they were singing a lot of songs from West Side Story, which was a big hit about that time. And I watched this bloody battle all night. None of the other guys in the ward were interested in it for some reason. They wouldn't look. And I'd had a little experience doing play-by-play sports at one time. So I did a blow-by-blow description of the rumble in the parking lot for the rest of the ward. And later, a guy from Youngstown told me that he knew I was in DTs, but it sounded so good he got up and looked anyway. You he kept laying in bed, you know, and he said, this guy's throwing a Jerry, but it sounds, I better take a look, you know. And he'd get up and go look. There was nothing going on. They knocked me out with some orange juice and something, I don't know what, in the morning, and I slept most of that day. And by afternoon, after the second shift nurse had come on, and I was still in bed, still sleeping. She woke me up and talked to me for a couple of minutes, and she had heard about the rumble outside. She said, I hear you had a pretty good show going last night, Jim. And kidded me, asked me if I was going to put it on TV and stuff. I was not exactly an anonymous drunk, you see. Everybody had seen me doing the news and on TV. But she asked me if I was going to put it on TV and kidded me about this scene. And I said, you mean it wasn't really there? And she said, what do you think, Jim? And walked out of the room. And you know, that's the first time for a long time anybody had asked me what I thought. Everybody had told me what they thought. They told me what they thought of me often. My wife told me, my father told me, my boss told me, everybody told me what they thought of me. But nobody had asked me what I thought. And I sat down on the edge of the bed and I thought about where I was, why I was there, what kind of a husband I was, what kind of a father I was, what kind of a worker I was, what kind of a man I had become. And I didn't like it. I think I took an inventory without even knowing that it was one of our steps, because I hadn't been paying any attention to the literature or to what anybody said to me up to that point. But I think also that I had an awakening of some kind, maybe spiritual awakening, at that time, because for the first time I faced myself, the truth, who I really was. I didn't like it, but I at least admitted it to myself. And I started to listen to what they said, and I started to read, trying to figure out what the secret was to sobriety. I remember how frustrating it was to try to read the literature. I couldn't understand it. My brain was so addled, I couldn't make sense out of good English. I remember sitting and looking at the paper and saying, my God, that starts with a capital letter and ends with a period. It's a sentence. I should be able to understand what it means. And I would read it again and had no idea what it said. So it was a real struggle. But I kept at it. I started to go to meetings after I got out of Rosary Hall. And some strange and wonderful things started to happen to me. I refer to that as an awakening. We in AA, I think, often use spiritual awakening and spiritual experience interchangeably. To me, they're two different things. I think back on that as an awakening, and many things that have happened to me since as the experience. After all, experience isn't something you get in a flash, you know. A guy doesn't play shortstop one game and become an experienced shortstop. Usually a young ball player is weak at it, doesn't hit very well, doesn't catch very well, doesn't throw very well. But as he plays day after day, making errors from time to time, he gets stronger and better at it, a little bit at a time. Well, I had had no spiritual experience whatsoever in my life up to that point. So it's no wonder I was pretty bad at it and made a lot of mistakes. But staying with it and doing my best, making fewer mistakes, getting stronger, I'll still make mistakes, still make errors. Even an experienced shortstop still makes errors once in a while. He just makes less than he used to. And somebody else will say, hey, there's an experienced shortstop. So at some point, somebody will say, there's a guy with some spiritual experience. And I think I have had some. The meetings were great. I enjoyed them immediately. I was told to get in with both feet and really take part and really enjoy them. I ended up in a very good group, there was one guy that I sort of unofficially appointed my sponsor, although he wasn't officially my sponsor, but he was a 20-year man in 1960. That means he came on the program in 1940. He was one of the first guys, and he was the chairman of my home group. I learned a lot from him. And one night, they had handed me, this was my second or third meeting, they had handed me a broom after the meeting, and I knew what they wanted me to do with it. And I was sweeping the floor, and I looked over, and my wife was sitting talking to this guy, Howard was his name. My wife was talking to Howard at a table, and they were watching me sweep the floor, and they were laughing. And it didn't strike me too funny at this point. And I ended up over near him, and I said, "What the hell's so funny?" And my wife said, "I was just telling Howard that it was only about a month ago you and I had an argument, and I told you if you didn't quit drinking, you'd end up sweeping floors." And I remembered that argument, and I remembered her saying that. Here I'd been sober 2 weeks and was looking for a medal, and I was sweeping floors. And happy to do it. Some strange things started to happen to me. I, as I said, had no spiritual experience. I didn't really know how this prayer thing worked. And I got my job back. My boss took me back. And he, as I think I mentioned, was a former newspaper man. And he tried to get radio and TV guys and newspaper people together. There's no great love lost between those two businesses. And he used to try to get us together. And he threw a big Christmas luncheon every year in December. And it really was an excuse for an afternoon drunk, is what it was. It was a lunch, but there was an awful lot of sparkling burgundy that flowed at that lunch, and toasts. And it was sort of a roast. The newspaper guys would take shots at the radio and TV guys, and vice versa. And the toasts would go all the way around the table. It was a nice party. It was in a very good restaurant, and it was always well served. And it was coming up, and the boss had talked to me about going, and I didn't want to go. But he wanted me to be there. Now, I wasn't afraid that I'd drink, but what I was really afraid of was that the toasts, as I mentioned, everybody knew I was a drunk. And I knew that these toasts were going to be very insulting, and I was going to be the goat of the joke, and nobody likes that. And also, I knew that I was going to end up with a glass of red wine in front of me, blinking on and off like a red neon sign. Here's the one with the drinking problem. Everybody else will drink their wine, and mine will still be sitting there, pointing at the drunk, the station lush. I talked to my sponsor about it, but I went to the party anyway. And as I sat there, the wine glasses, goblets with the long stems, were on the table upside down. And there were two waiters. One of them had a polishing cloth, a little towel. He came by and turned the glass up and squished it out with the polishing cloth, one of those little gracious gestures that good waiters do. The second one had the bottle wrapped in a towel, and he'd fill your glass. And they were very professional. Down the line they came, up, swish, pour, up, swish, pour, up, swish, pour. They got to me, and the guy turned my glass up, swished it out, and the guy with the bottle turned it back upside down and went by me so fast I couldn't even smell the wine, let alone get it. That bottle was just zip, gone. And I toasted with my water glass, and they kidded me about the TV news, but nothing personal. There were no insulting toasts. Newspaper guys, I couldn't believe it. But it was easy and comfortable and fun. I really enjoyed that party for the first time. And I saw the waiter later in the corner, and I went over to him and I said, "Did my boss tell you to do that?" And he said, "Hell no, I saw you at a meeting last Tuesday night." So I went home and told my sponsor. What a coincidence, I said. I drew an AA waiter, and he went right down my throat. What do you mean coincidence, he said. Did you say your prayer before you went to that party? I said, yeah. He said, what do you say when you pray? I said, well, I say I'm an alcoholic. I want to stay sober. I'll do my best. But help me if it gets difficult, or show me the way if I get lost. He said, okay, you ask for help, you got help. What the hell is so coincidental about that? Go home tonight and thank him. And I did. And I've been doing that ever since. And it's been happening to me ever since. One way or another, it happens. It happens not every day, or it maybe does happen every day. I just don't notice it every day. I'm not sure. But I know there have been some outstanding moments when I've noticed it. I not only got my job back, I got a new show. I became the producer and host of a program that ended up winning 3 Emmys. And it was a travel and adventure show that sent me all over the world shooting film to make travelogues. I've been to meetings in South America, in England, in the Orient, in Asia. Wonderful opportunity. I'd never, I couldn't get to Niagara Falls sober when I was drinking. But the sobriety sent me off on world tours and on lecture tours and as an illustrated lecturer with film and a very popular and successful TV show. And a lot of wonderful things started to happen. About 3 years sober, I was in Hong Kong shooting a film, and I had a guide, a young 21-year-old Chinese boy, college student who worked part-time as a guide, and he was with me all week showing me around Hong Kong. So we had several meals together, and he always had a beer with his meal, and I always had a Coke. And he noticed that I didn't drink, and that was unusual, he thought, for an American who didn't drink. So he asked me about it, and I said, well, I used to drink a lot, so I don't drink at all anymore. And he said, oh, you must be an AA. And I said, yeah, how do you know about AA? There was no AA in Hong Kong. Well, there was. There were 2 groups in Hong Kong at that time. 4 members in each group. And there were 2 guys listed in the World Directory as independents. They didn't belong to either group. So there were 10 AAs in a city of about 4 million people. And there's this kid asking me if I'm an AA. And I said, how did you learn about AA? And he said, we learned about it at Hong Kong University. He said, they taught us about AA and what a wonderful job it did. And he said, I wish my father had had the opportunity you have to get sober in AA. And he told me his father's story. His father was a traveling salesman. They sold silk. They were from Shantung province. And he sold silk all over Asia. Fell into the trap that a lot of traveling salesmen do. Drank too much, and it killed him. And the boy knew it. And he knew there was something called AA that could have saved his life if it had been available. And he sat at lunch and told me how lucky I was to be from a city where there was AA, and how grateful I must be for my sobriety. He gave me one of the best AA talks I've ever had in my life, and he'd never been to a meeting in his life. Here it comes out of a 21-year-old Chinese boy who's never been to a meeting in his life, and he's given me straight AA, face to face. I went back to my hotel that night, and when I asked for my room key, the clerk handed me an envelope with the room key, and he said, oh, you're a lucky winner today. I said, what do you mean, lucky winner? And he said, we have a drawing every day. One of our guests wins a door prize, and you're the winner today. So I thought, I'm in Hong Kong, I've won a new suit, maybe, something like that. I opened the envelope, and I had won a bottle of scotch. And I'd had that lecture at lunch that day. I just handed the envelope back to the clerk. Said, better give that lucky prize to some other lucky person, because I can't use it. I needed that day, I think. And boy, did I get it, huh? I'm one of those guys who said, when it comes to spiritual stuff, you got to show me. Well, he's shown me over and over and over. He shows me all the time. I learned to look in, look up, and look out. It became one of my favorite expressions. I don't know where I heard that, at a meeting somewhere. But I looked into AA. They taught me how to look up to a higher power and look out for that first ring. And that's become sort of a motto with me. Look in, look up, and look out. There have been a lot of results of sobriety. There's really only one reward, and that's the sobriety itself. When I was a little kid, I was taught that virtue is its own reward, and I never really knew what that meant. I never understood that. But I understand it now, because the reward for being sober is the sobriety. That's the reward. That's what you get for being sober. But there are a lot of other results. I told you I got a new show. I made a lot more money. I didn't spend as much money, obviously. But I made a lot more money. So there was all the stuff that goes with that, cars and a house and clothes and all of that sort of thing. I didn't get rich, but I don't think I was supposed to. I always had enough. Since I've been sober, I've had enough. More than enough for me might be too much. Maybe that's all I'm supposed to have is enough. And that's okay by me. There have been many other of those incidents. I remember having a furnace man in the house one day fixing my furnace. And I had a tape of a talk, an AA talk, and I wanted to play it. And I didn't want to play it in front of this furnace man. And it was getting later and later, and took him longer and longer to fix the furnace. And I had to go to work. I was working a late shift that afternoon, and I had to go pretty soon. So I finally said, what the hell? I don't care about him. I'm going to play the tape. But I thought I better set him up for it. And so I said, I'm going to play a tape here, and it's a speech, and it won't probably mean anything to you at all, but I want to listen to it. It was a speech made at an AA meeting. And he said, oh, good, we'll have a meeting right here. I belong to the... And he was one of us. And the two of us sat there and listened to the tape while he fixed my furnace. That sort of thing has happened to me over and over and over. One of the strangest things that ever happened to me was a meeting in Tokyo that I went to. And I don't speak any Japanese. And the entire meeting was in Japanese. And I didn't understand one word that was spoken all night long. But I knew what was going on. I could tell when they were doing the Lord's Prayer. I could tell when they were doing the Serenity Prayer. I understood everything that went on at that meeting, and I caught myself laughing at the guy's jokes. Everybody else was laughing, so I laughed. You know, it was a wonderful meeting. I walked out of there feeling like I did, you know, at any other meeting. And I didn't understand a word that was spoken. So I know there's value at these meetings, whether the speaker's any good or not. There's a lot of value. I discovered that early on. I went to a morning meeting. I'd only been sober a few months, maybe. And there are meetings all day long around Cleveland. And I went to a morning meeting, and the speaker that morning was a guy doing his first lead, as we used to call him. And he was a factory worker, a young fellow, probably never spoke before an audience in his life. Probably one of those kids that never recited in school because he was shy and felt inadequate. And he got up and spoke for about 5 minutes and didn't say anything and sat down. And I was sitting there being critical, saying, this is a waste of time this morning. Why did I come all the way over here? Why am I at this meeting? This does me no good whatsoever. And suddenly I was aware that there was a guy in the front row, an old-timer, who was on his feet telling this kid what a good job he did and what a nice story that was and how much he enjoyed it and how much it helped him. And I thought, what's he talking about? And then another guy got up, and he said about the same thing. And complimented this young man on what a wonderful job he had done. And this kid was sitting up straighter and straighter and smiling more and more. And by the time these old timers got through with him, he thought he'd given the Gettysburg Address. Because they convinced him that he had done a good job and he felt good and he was smiling and happy when he walked out of that meeting. And tell you the truth, so was I. Because I thought, this is a pretty good group I've joined. I don't know of any other group in the world that would go out of their way to make that young man feel at home and welcome and that he was doing a great job, except this one. This is the only kind of group I've ever had anything to do with that would do, that would be that thoughtful, that considerate, that helpful to another person. I mentioned to you that I was on the lecture circuit for a while, and I had a date one night in Roswell, New Mexico. I had been in Odessa, Texas on Saturday night, and I had a date in Roswell on Monday night. I had a rented car and I drove over there. So I got there Sunday evening and looked in the phone book for an AA meeting, and I couldn't find AA listed in the phone book in Roswell. So it wasn't real serious. You know, I didn't really need a meeting. It was just something to do. I ended up watching TV or something. But the next afternoon, I got a phone call, and it was a guy who was originally from Cleveland, who recognized, he saw my picture in the paper, and he recognized me from TV, and he called me at the hotel and said he'd also been to a few meetings with me, which, of course, I knew he was an AA, too. He was a retired school teacher. And he asked me if I wanted to go to a meeting with him that night, and I told him I couldn't. I was speaking that night at the Roswell Inn, but that I had looked for a meeting the night before and couldn't find one. And he said, oh, we're in the yellow pages, which never occurred to me to look. Anyway, he said, would you like to come over after your speech tonight? Our meeting's at 7, and all these people will go home and go to bed. They're all farmers, and they go to bed early. But we do have a clubhouse, and we'll have some coffee on, and there'll be a few people around. We can just have a conversation. So I said, sure. And sure enough, they picked me up, and they went over. We went over to this clubhouse and walked in, and there were about 25 or 30 people sitting there. And a chairman rapped his gavel and said, okay, we can hold a meeting now. And I said, I thought you said your meetings were at 7. And he said, oh, yeah, we had a meeting at 7. And I said, it's now 9 o'clock. And he said, well, I told him that there was a guy in town who was looking for a meeting last night and couldn't find one. So they all decided to hold another meeting tonight just for you. We don't want you going back to Hawaii telling people you couldn't find a meeting in Roswell. Those people stuck around and stayed up late to hold a meeting for a total stranger, for a guy they never saw before in their life. I don't know of any group in the world that would do that other than AA. And that's the way it's gone for me since I got sober. I could go on and on, but I've traded in a lot of stuff. I traded in the humiliation, the embarrassment, the degradation, and I got back for it, experience, strength, and hope. I got that from you. I traded in trouble. I still have problems once in a while, but I'm not in trouble. And there's a big difference between having a problem and being in trouble. I traded in that search for a moment of pleasure for a life of happiness. And boy, if you don't know the difference between a moment of pleasure and a life of happiness, I feel sorry for you, because there's a big difference. And what a wonderful trade that was. All of the bad stuff pretty much has gone. I still have my days, but I heard when I came on the program that my worst day sober would be better than my best day drunk. And that's been true, although I cannot remember what my best day drunk was. Can't remember one of them. And I've had some pretty bad days sober. I lost my wife 7 years ago. My parents have gone. A lot of friends have gone. When you get to be my age, you know, that's when you start looking at the obituaries every day, and if you're not in it, you're happy. And then you go play golf or go to a meeting or do something. And I've been very fortunate in that respect and able to handle problems when they come along, and sadness when it comes along, and it does. It has to. How do you know you're happy if you don't have days of sadness? But I traded in a lot of bad stuff, and what I got back was a lot of good stuff. Why me? I don't know. That group that started out drinking together in high school, Howard and Joe, me, Howard committed suicide in his early 30s, shot himself. He had tried AA and it didn't work, he said. Joe ended up living under a bridge in Cleveland and ended up being back in Rosary Hall for a second shot. He had pneumonia. He's not supposed to have a second chance at Rosary Hall, but he was sick, so Sister Ignatia gave him a bed. He died, however. He did not have a second chance coming. She tried to give him a second chance. Everybody wanted him to have a second chance. He did not have a second chance coming. I don't know whether I have a second chance coming or not, and I don't want to know. I don't want to find out, not at those prices. So I don't know. Why me? Of course, if you stop to think of it, I don't know if anybody ever won the lottery and said, oh, God, why me? You know, you only say, oh, God, why me when you're in trouble. All I know is that I didn't really ask for any the right things. I asked for a lot of stuff. Even when I was drinking, I used to pray, oh, God, get me out of this one, and I'll never take another drink as long as I live. You've heard that prayer before, I'm sure. I never kept the promise. I got that out of the trouble, but I never kept the promise. I picked this up at a meeting early on, and I've carried it or had it near me ever since. I don't know where it came from. I'm told that it was found in the pocket of a Confederate soldier, which is possibly true, but I'm not sure. But I've carried it because it is so appropriate for me. It said, I asked God for strength that I might achieve, and I was made weak that I might learn humbly to obey. I asked for health that I might do greater things. I was given infirmity that I might do better things. I asked for riches that I might be happy. I was given poverty that I might be wise. I asked for power that I might have the praise of men. I was given weakness that I might feel the need of God. I asked for all things that I might enjoy life. I was given life that I might enjoy all things. I got nothing that I asked for, but everything that I had hoped for. Almost despite myself, my unspoken prayers are answered. And I am among all men most richly blessed. I wish you all the same blessings, and thank you for letting me share with you this morning.